Welcome to the Pendulum Insight Podcast. This is a show for deal makers in the blockchain business, where we meet the players who are changing the game today and get their insight into everything from the red tape to the raise. This is your host, Colton Moffitt. Let's get started. Hey everybody, we're here again, this time with Ben Wilkening and Philip Soichanu. They are directors of strategic relationships at TokenIQ. Now, if you haven't already heard of TokenIQ, it's an asset-backed securities token issuance platform built on the Stellar distributed ledger. So without going much further into all that, I'm going to let them explain it for us. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today. Why don't you just tell us more about how you got involved in the blockchain space, your individual backgrounds, and then we'll move on to TokenIQ.
Yeah, that's great. I'll start, I guess. I got involved with TokenIQ actually by meeting Mark Vange, our founder, CEO, and inventor of the technology itself, back in, I guess it was late 2016 it was about late 2016 when I actually met Mark, and he was at the time selling this idea just to high net worth individuals around town here in Phoenix. And one of my financial advisory buddies needed me along because I was one of the only people that had any clue what blockchain was at the time. And this was a concept derived in this new burgeoning industry. So I went, saw Mark's pitch, and it was kind of serendipitous because one of the wireframes that I'd started to kind of draw around ideas for was built around different forms of compliance and achieving that through distributed means, and not exactly with the SEC compliance, but what I had in my notebook was similar enough where I said, oh geez, like I was just looking up at the whiteboard the whole time saying, he's designed something pretty compelling here and he's already got the patents filed. Clearly I'm interested in this. I got to meet him. Yeah. So I kind of showed him these doodles afterwards. He's like, yeah, whoa, you know your stuff. Like, let's keep talking. And we just became a once every 2 week or so conversation while he kind of was securing funding for this thing, figuring out if he was actually going to build it out. Mm-hmm. That's all she wrote from there. Once Mark had started the company to the point where we had some funding in place, we had our company president, Alex mm-hmm. Dio, join the team. I was the first one that called to hire to help grow out this effort and get it into people's minds. And I came by way of blockchain actually when I had a solar power company prior. The thing that got me into it was the last mile problem. Mm-hmm. I was looking at different ways of disintermediating control of people's utilities and energies away from the utility companies, because come to find out they're just big cartels with lobbyists, special interest groups themselves, and they gouge all the way they can. And this was a big enough problem for me to kind of dive in and say, all right, what's possible here? And I discovered blockchain by way of that and started designing my company around solving for that. The credit markets froze up right around the time where Mark started to need the resources on this side of the equation. So it was fine because there was only like a 2 month hiatus there where I was exiting my solar power and company and closing it all down and coming into this opportunity. But it all happened so quick that it's funny even recalling it. It was just divine intervention type of stuff. But that's me. Philip, why don't you give it a shot there? Hopefully I didn't overextend my welcome.
Yeah, sure. Tell us where you came into this one, Philip. This is already interesting. So when do you come into this picture?
Well, basically, I'll just give you a really quick background on how I wound up here. I have been in the capital markets, financial services space for almost 20 years, mostly on the consulting side, but not so much the investment consulting side, more the business strategy, market strategy side. for a while looking at asset flows, asset gathering, asset allocation, mostly in European markets, just because I had done part of my MBA in Europe and I spoke a lot of European languages. So my first company that was at Cerulli Associates sent me to cover those markets. Then I went to Aite Group, which does more of a fintech, financial technology, thought leadership coverage. So my background for the last few years had been in the fintech space. I launched my own consulting firm, Lightship Strategies, which also did fintech consulting. During that time, went to law school, became a lawyer, realized I didn't want to be a lawyer, went back into consulting. But for about the last 3-4 years, since around 2014, 2015, a lot of our clients had been coming to us with questions on what is blockchain, what's distributed ledger, what's it going to mean in the financial services space, in the capital market space. So we have been doing a lot of projects for our clients, writing a lot of white papers, position papers, and I had for about 3-4 years been looking at the blockchain space. And I had, you meet a lot of people in the space, especially around 16, 17, and a lot of them had very, very grandiose ideas, let's say. And a lot of the people I met, I liked their ideas, I just didn't know if the execution was going to be there. So I was a little bit hesitant to really jump out of the consulting world into the actual blockchain DLT world. Yeah. Fortunately, this past summer, actually late summer, early fall, I was at a few conferences, bumped into a friend of mine that I knew for a while, and he mentioned, hey, I know these great guys who are in town, and those great guys happen to be Ben and Alex Diao, our co-founder and president, and we all went out to grab some sushi and talked, and it was supposed to be a quick 1 hour grab a bite of sushi, turn into probably about a 6 or 7 hour conversation talking about Token IQ and a bunch of other things related to the industry. And I realized that these are, as I like to tell people, these are sort of the adults in the room, the grown-ups in the room. Because again, my specialty for a while had been securities regulation, and Token IQ was really, from what I can tell, one of the first, if not the only, tokenization platform out there that from day one, from the foundation, had the mantra and the vision that securities laws have been around for about 80 years. The 33 Act, 34 Act have been around for about 80 years. There's no point to try to really circumvent them and go around them. Let's build something that is compliant. Let's build something that follows the laws. And of course, eventually, when the laws change, that whether it be in 6 months, a year, 5 years, we'll be in a position where we can adapt. So I really was on board with the idea, the message, and the technology, and I decided time to join them, time to finally make the big plunge, and I'm happy I did.
Excellent. That's something that I really have liked about getting to know more about Token IQ and the research leading up to this interview, and just in general, I obviously running in blockchain partnerships and just through my research, I had a lot of different companies I encounter, which again, like you said, there's a lot of great ideas out there, but sometimes it's a little bit hard to wrap my head around how they're going to do what they want to do or whether or not anybody really asked them to, you know, and that's something you see a lot with any kind of startup. But with Token IQ, it's often, it's really pleasant when you can look at something, oh, that makes sense. This is how they're doing it. This is why they're doing it. This is exactly what they're doing. I could explain this to somebody who doesn't really understand blockchain and they won't need to understand that part so much. And so that's, well, I'm really excited to get more into that. So, you know, I guess let's talk about what sets Token IQ apart from other tokenization solutions, because obviously there are some great alternatives out there. There are a lot of people that are looking to you guys and your, you know, competitors, for lack of a term, your cohorts for these solutions. And going into 2019, it's going to be a very big deal seeing how everything plays out in practical terms. So what sets Token IQ apart?
That's a really good question. It's funny because it's not like what a lot of people probably would expect. And you were starting to actually touch on it there with the last anecdote you were talking about, Colton, with introducing people to Token IQ, it being easier to talk about what solution we've provided because we really do skate around the periphery of the blockchain space. We don't self-identify even as a blockchain company. We've created a piece of software that leverages distributed ledger technology, but at the end of the day, distinct model number one is we're self software as a service company, SaaS model, where we have specific deliverables and specific procedurals, project-based delivery requirements that are all based around that type of software development lifecycle. Mm-hmm. And we just kind of looked at Stellar, which is the distributed ledger tech that we of choosing for our platform, as a new type of development language that can do some really cool stuff. And starting with that in mind, we didn't actually mind creating a creed for ourselves that's a little bit different from our frenemies. Our frenemies being our competitors, we just don't call them competitors because it's more of a collaborative relationship most days than not. And, sure. And we're talking to Mark from over at Polymath, mm-hmm. In relationships like this where it's just idea sharing and we're all trying to solve the same thing. Yeah. But our approach to it is certainly where others kind of challenge us is that we don't mind giving up a little bit of central authority to people that in the process of an STO and an issuance in general should have it anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's really the magic of what we've created is we've mimicked the traditional environment from which the SEC laws come from. Those laws and acts that Philip mentioned that are largely unchanged since 1933 and 1934. Mm-hmm. We say there are specific actions embedded in there that are, you know, Department of Justice sanctioned actions basically that courts can use to talk with traditional issuers. And one of the key things, recover lost shares, lost funds. Mm-hmm. And that was what was glaringly missing from a lot of the solutions we're looking at out there. And we pretty soon determined that it was because of smart contracts. There's a design constraint with smart contracts with the recoverability of things. Stellar allows for this. And therein lies the rub of where we don't mind giving the central authority up to a Department of Justice sanctioned action. Mm. As we've talked about, Colton, but I'll kind of reiterate here for your listeners,
yeah,
is that there is a huge conundrum that exists within how the SEC views smart contract-based tokens, even if they're claiming that they're an STO. Just because you self-identify yourself as an STO doesn't really necessarily doesn't mean you have the legal backing of everything that would make that instrument perform as such. Mm. And recoverability of funds is that big one, the glaring thing in everybody's mind. The Quadriga situation right now would be a lot different if Token IQ-esque technology were put in place at the exchange level, right?
Yeah.
And this exchange recoverability, or the, I shouldn't call it exchange recovery, token recoverability, on this fictitious exchange that we're talking about, if a hack were to occur or a death were to occur, just as is going on right now, all that would have to happen is that the claimants on the ownership of those funds go use the exact same proceedings that are in place in the traditional environment. Mm. You take your claim to the court, you plead your case, say, hey, look, I have a whole bunch of beneficiaries for these wallets that nobody can get into. We need access to these.
Yeah.
And the court says, okay. They take an affidavit and they send it over to the issuer of whoever the tokens originated from. In our case, it would be the issuers that use the Token IQ platform.
Yeah.
And using that affidavit, they can compel the issuer to one time destroy the credentials of the wallets that are holding these funds and place them into new ownership with new credentials. Mm. It's essentially kind of like blowing open a safe with dynamite, taking the same funds that were out of there and placing them in a new wallet with credentials. This is no problem to us because something that's funny about making a compliant platform is that it references these acts that the SEC enforces.
Right.
But the Department of Justice is ahead of it all. So if we're just playing a war game here and we're going to assume that, okay, let's just say that the court system gets corrupt, our platform really doesn't matter anyway. So we're really only selling a platform within the constraints of that, of that channel.
Right.
And it all reconciles out there. There's also no reason we see it to invest money in an entity that you don't trust implicitly in the first place. And it's because it's the issuer, the central, which is given the central authority to destroy these wallets and take those tokens and make new credentials, right? They can't just keep repeating this action either, by the way. They need another court-ordered affidavit from another customer to incite this to them in order to take action on it in the future as well. So it's a one-time deal, kind of a pain in the butt to get it done. We'll be honest. We don't want it to be easy. But there is a remediative path. I mean, it takes away the risks for custodial services to be able to hold funds and things like this too. It's not just exchanges that can use this type of functionality. More importantly, though, it's what needs to be in place for our downstream issuance partners to be able to serve their customers. And again, kind of wrapping this all up, all of this is possible because we had a difference in mindset. That's really all it is. But all of these frenemies of ours, they're completely capable of designing, I think, a similar type of solution, but the decentralization blockage in their head, while I cheer for that in most capacities, it just doesn't have an argument to play here with this type of a designed instrument. So
gotcha.
Real simple thing can make all the difference. You know, it all boils down to technology selection for us.
Sure. And what you've done is, correct me if I'm wrong, essentially create a technology, create a tool set that is agnostic to whatever situation or framework it exists in. So for now, it's been set up to reflect the way that the system is designed in the United States, for better or worse. That's the operating environment that you're in, therefore it reflects that. And if it was to be the UK or Germany or anywhere else, then you know it would comply to the regulations of that area. So with that being said, obviously within this ecosystem you have people that are trying to use the technology to push their philosophical or their ideological wishes, which is totally, like, I mean, that's really fascinating that it's possible and it's very cool. And one thing that we've talked about before is it's not necessarily that you don't individually hold some, you know, philosophy to be better than others or one that you find most advantageous for people, but there's a certain value to the boiling of the frog thing. Instead of it always being done to you, maybe it's like, hey, let's make this a thing that is palatable and good and works within the existing framework. It's a thing that somebody who's coming from traditional finance or traditional government model says, okay, we can do all this. This is okay. And then you achieve your change and your progression in the way that things are structured over time by making it functional and palatable right now, like today, tomorrow.
That's actually a really important point. We can't fail in our delivery of compliance, right? You only get one shot at that.
Right.
In fact, if you're claiming compliance and it's not, then you've got some serious marketing issues ahead of you to prove yourself out of that hole that you've dug.
Yeah.
So we take all of these points very seriously and you know, cross all the T's, dotted all the I's in our design. It's not, you're right, it's not just the technology selection, but we did have, there was some smarts that had to be put to this in the invention process that mostly can be accredited to Mark, of course, because he's some sort of a otherworldly genius.
But, yeah, I saw something like, what was it? I don't want to get this wrong. 37 or 67 patents, something.
It's well, with Token IQ, it's in the 60s now. He's a lot, like half of his patents that he's ever written are like for this platform. So he's been writing a lot of them because it's really legally heavy. He comes from media and entertainment and video games as his previous industries.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't know those ones as well. So I couldn't, I know his exploits. I know what he's delivered. He's had seven successful company exits in his past. He's 7 for 7. That should tell you something.
It does. And it's something that stands out in an environment where there's been a lot of bad PR because of how many ICOs turned out to not be solid. Whether or not they were scams, I don't, you know, whatever, let's not go down that rabbit hole. But staying positive, staying focused on what's going to happen this year, let's turn now just quickly to Phil. What do you think you'd most like to see when it comes to development of tokenized assets and how that's going to play out this year in 2019?
Well, the platform we offer is really applicable to a lot of really different kinds of assets, everything from equities to debt to even fine art, for example, collectible cars, really any sort of asset can be tokenized. But the one that we seem to be gravitating towards in 2019, and this is happening sort of as an internal and external sort of organic direction for us, is the real estate market and real estate development. When you look at the whole real estate market globally, traditionally, for decades or even hundreds of years, the assets there are very illiquid, and essentially the value that's there is really just locked up. Let's say you're a real estate developer and you're doing a relatively small $10 million deal on a property, whether you're building something, redeveloping something, to find investors that are willing to put up. Even if you're able to find 10 investors at $1 million each, that's a pretty big ask, and it's a long term commitment. You're looking at a project that could take a couple of years. What we're able to do, we're able to fractionalize that issuance, whether it's a real redevelopment project that's issuing equity or issuing debt, or it's actually buying tokens within the project itself. Our platform is able to fractionalize that down so that now the developer, instead of having to go out and find maybe 5 to 10, maybe half a dozen potential investors that are able and willing to lock up several $1 million for quite a substantial amount of time, and then face an illiquidity risk, mm-hmm. and then if they have to exit that position, we can fractionalize that down to buy-ins of 50,000 US, mm-hmm. or 100,000 US or equivalent, and it's much easier to find a few hundred or so investors that are able to afford and able to lock up $50,000, $100,000 for a while than it is to find people with they're able to lock up a few million. And when you get down to the $50,000 range, right, let's say, mm-hmm. now you're opening up that investment to doctors, lawyers, successful executives, small business owners that have been successful and they want to diversify their investments. They want to take advantage of a growing property market, whether it's in their own town, their own neighborhood, or globally even. And one other benefit that comes from that is now when you add liquidity to a market, whether it's a real estate market or any capital market for that matter, once you add liquidity and you have investors who know in the back of their mind that, well, if anything happens, I can always exit this and after a lockup period, of course, mm-hmm. but they know I can exit this and I can get back into it if I have to, and I can get out of it if I have to, and I can have access to that capital. They're much more willing to take that investment on, to take the actual risk of the investment without having the risk of illiquidity.
Right.
Now, if you remove that risk, you attract much more investors. Now, you attract more investors, your investment and the underlying asset and the shares become more valuable. So for issuers, they're actually able to raise more capital because now they are not factoring in, they're not pricing in that illiquidity penalty. Mm-hmm. And lastly, once you do have a more liquid market for these tokens, you have more pricing transparency. If you have more pricing transparency, it's much more comfortable and again, it reduces even the risk even further for investors, because now they can look at the investment and say, well, the last 30, 40 times these tokens were bought and sold, this was the price, this was the value. Right. I'm comfortable knowing what I'm getting, as opposed to trying to invest in something that is traded maybe once a year, once every 3 years. The analogy I give is, you can find out how much your share of Apple was 5 seconds ago.
Yeah.
You know, you can know to the penny, any given time of the day, how much a share of a publicly traded security is. How much is the last Picasso worth? How much is the next Picasso worth? Well, the last few were sold for between 10 million and 100 million or whatever it was. So it's hard to really value it. More price transparency and more liquidity you have, the easier it is to value, and the easier it is to value, the more willing people are to invest. And essentially, at the end of the day, you're unlocking a lot of that value that's been locked up in property for a long time. So that's where we're seeing 2019 taking us.
Excellent. So, you know, we have some fascinating opportunities to learn about this year, and it's great to talk to you guys about how you see Token IQ helping to create those opportunities or to be a part of those. And because you've already decided long ago to work within the existing regulatory framework, and you've emphasized the efficiency gains and cost reduction there, but also one thing that you brought up a lot, Phil in particular, was the risk reduction, risk management element of it, not only for the investors, but also for the issuers, and how that enables them to attract capital, particularly from not just the larger institutions or the, you know, more capable investors that might have teams for due diligence. They already have a process and they know what they want, versus now you've got this opportunity for maybe the professional class, so to speak. It's a dirty word in America, but you know what I mean. That is unfortunately often the prey of sophisticated con artists. They go after people who are attorneys, who are well-to-do accountants, doctors, and you know, this is because they may not have the most direct financial acumen that's needed, but they are very well-educated people and they do have means and they have access to means to go and make these investments. But there's an element of playing on a person's desire to, well, you know, I have a PhD in whatever, or I'm a doctor. Of course, I've had enough education. I can certainly see this is a good investment. So unfortunately, that gets preyed upon. And this creates a way, well, blockchain solutions to that problem, meaning, yes, they can see that price transparency. They can see, yes, the due diligence has been done. All the other people who are investing in this, it's not just this person's uncle or some shady co-conspirators. So would you guys just go into that a little bit more about how Token IQ is going to facilitate the risk reduction side of things?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the risk reduction things in particular share a lot of the same core concepts for STO providers in general. Mm-hmm. Some of these aren't wholly unique to Token IQ. So if we start talking in generalities and, you know, they start to bleed in with actual features that are uniquely Token IQ, I guess listener discretion advice. That's how I should say it. Right. But the risk reduction comes with pretty key things that you can rely on a distributed ledger to accomplish for you in general, right? The immutability standard is still there. This is something that, even though we don't have the blockchain component tied to it yet, that's to say there's no validated work model on the back end plugging things into a database when you're printing securities. It's actually not altogether necessary that be the security measure that you used, because we actually have laws that tell us what we should or should not be doing. Mm-hmm. And what we've rather done in so many ways is eliminate the propensity for committees to form on the side of an issuance after it's gone through, because in essence, that's all that's really done today. We have capitulated markets, you can argue, from many other angles. We won't get into the how or why or what of that, because that's actually a debate in and of itself. You'll have people on Wall Street chime in saying, no, that's not the case. It's not my position. Hmm. But the reason why is because you can prove beyond any reasonable doubt and beyond statistical significance both that the amount of volumes traded for specific assets or commodities, for instance, eclipsed the entire universe of available on market in a manner of 2-3 days sometimes, especially in crypto. Mm. You take a look at some of the currencies like Litecoin, and you just take a look at one of the big exchanges, they'll turn over the entire universe of Litecoin in 3 days. I don't see how that's possible, and I don't see how that proves price to anybody, right? Mm. So it's proves price, but how people can trust the pricing that comes out of that.
Okay.
When you take technology like the distributed ledger and you automate specific key functions, authentications, validations, legal considerations, signatures, these things can all be transmitted directly on, and their immutable qualities will disprove them from ever being false, right? So once they're there, they're referenceable. Mm-hmm. And you can do this with common exit routines. You can do it with common trade functions, with common clearinghouse functions. That's not to say that we've built all of those yet, right? Clearinghouse is not something we've built, but mm-hmm. we've built the tools to support somebody that wants to build a clearinghouse and remove middlemen from touching it. Because using TokenIQ's technology, all we've done is we've infused legal compliance, SEC laws, and considerations onto the very logic of the tokens. So if an issuer comes to us and they say, I just want to create an equity offering, mm-hmm. we're not ostensibly doing anything different than if they were to go create a traditional offering via a stock share. The difference is we're digitally representing it, and all of the things that would normally check it and audit it are always on constantly.
Yeah.
So you don't ever have to hire a professional if you don't need to at some point. Yeah. Financial auditors that audit financial CPA or accounting data are not going to have nearly as hard of a time at finding the data they need, because it can be reduced down to a search term. Mm. To say, oh, I need to find this piece of information in this date range. Let me find it, right? It's all in the ledger. So you take that risk out of the equation. You take the risk of transference out of the equation, because you can see the hashing happening, right? So you can also take the risk out of the token recovery model and the custodianship because of what we've uniquely built in. And that's one of those topics we've already discussed.
Sure.
So you'll see the unique blend of features that we've built in, and because it's on Stellar and not a smart contract, we've reduced all of that risk back out. And one of those other key pieces that kind of differentiates what a platform like Stellar is capable of versus Ethereum is that there's not really a good way to legally approve, I'll say, a transaction that's made in Ethereum. Hmm. If you take a position in an STO using gas, what are you really doing? You're not using money. This isn't actually a sanctioned transaction that you're executing at that point. You're hydrating money into another token mechanism, a polymath or a harbor or one of our other frenemies, right? Mm-hmm. You then have to take that token that you hold a position in with them, and you have to convert it into an STO. What's the legality of that transaction? It's not covered with anything the SEC acts point to. Mm. And this is actually, I think, what most people are waiting on is, we need the guidance. And the SEC is not going to guide anybody. They only enforce laws. They're not really even a huge player in the legislation of. So right. I think we can count on the fact that we've got as a point further to the actual how do we reduce risk, why it's important to reduce risk on the correct technology. I'll just insert one more time. Sure. Another reason to trust different technologies for different things. And I'm not demonizing smart contracts either. They absolutely have their place to play with us, especially to inform certain routines that we're going to be doing on our chain. Mm. think about execution of specific documents, maybe, and you can bridge those over and inform what we do just fine. It's just not appropriate for the creation of security vehicles themselves.
Gotcha. Interesting.
And I'll actually add something to Ben's point, and a little bit because of my legal background. And what I think is also critical is that for issuers, when they can go to their prospective investors and tell them there's essentially zero risk that we are doing anything which would violate any regulation in terms of an issuance. We're not trying to circumvent any 33 Act, any regulations. We're not trying to skirt the Howey test, which is the traditional test to determine if an investment or essentially a contract is a security or not in the traditional sense. We're not violating any elements of any rules. That translates into confidence and less risk on the investor's part. And again, this goes back to what I said earlier. In any market and any asset, historically, the less risk there is, the less systemic risk, legal risk, the more easily you can attract investors. So for issuers, this is really a boon. And I think once this message, the Token IQ message that we preach, so to speak, gets out there, that you are able to use this new technology and still have it be compliant with all of your existing regulations, whether it's in the U.S. jurisdiction, or as we mentioned earlier, whether you're going to the U.K., whether you're going to Malta, Singapore, whichever jurisdiction you'd like to issue, you will actually be able to have sort of a premium on your issuance in the eyes of your investors, because it's one less thing for them to worry about. The risk of violating any regulations just helps bolster the legitimacy of your issuance even more. So that's one more thing. So
yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I know that that's been such a concern, and especially after what happened over the past year, and you know, not to look too far into that abyss, but basically you had some law firms, some advisors, some people that made a good bit of money. Now how much of it actually ended up as US dollars in their pockets at the end of the day is to be their own business, but they kind of got in some hot water because they went and gave some really ill-formed opinions and they staked their reputation on it, and we all know how quickly reputation can be destroyed. So that kind of careful approach is certainly worthwhile, and I've spoken to people who are, you know, founders or the core team of a number of early stage companies that they're not really sure who they can believe anymore. And there's a lot of information that's just sort of flying around about what's going to happen in this jurisdiction or that jurisdiction, and whose opinion of this particular statement made. It's a lot like fortune telling. So the whole approach of just being compliant out of the gate and focusing on that and making it more efficient and less expensive with the use of technology, I think that's solid. Can we talk now about the KYC AML situation and how Token IQ in particular addresses that?
Sure. Yeah, just like any other crypto technology, you got to prove who you are before you can use it. And ours is no different, of course. If we're going to be the ones claiming to supply full SEC compliance in other jurisdictions, then we have to provide the path for that. So
right.
Other than the tokenization piece, we've actually broken up the platform into kind of a two-part onboarding series with our issuers. And part one is completely dedicated to onboarding them on with not only their issuance and their offer, but the ability to take accredited investors straight through our platform. So we've hooked up the same database checks with KYC data that MasterCard, Visa, Bank of America, Chase, these guys all use.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, it's validated transaction history. It's largely United States. So caveat being is, as far as our platform is is designed right now, that particular KYC check is done as mostly a United States offering. Sure. We have other ways to do that in other jurisdictions, but SEC is what people care the most about. So that's how we go about getting that data. And just like any application proceeding, you got to prove who you are. Everybody that's done the wallet setup with any other exchange with any service that in the crypto realm will be familiar enough with the uploading of documents and proceedings around verifying of address, verifying name, verifying date of birth, all these things. Once we can match that up with your transaction history, we've actually got more data than most KYC providers have, and we've got an algorithmic scoring system that we're implementing for each one of our issuers.
Okay.
So the accreditation process, as it's going, right, you're uploading your documents, you're sending them to the issuer for the offering. The difference with Token IQ's upload process is we're also leveraging the distributed ledger to store the validation of the information on there too. So this document's needed for another offering. It's already validated. You don't need to revalidate this. Unique documents to the offering, of course, you're always going to need to put that on there. But each incremental marginal time you do that, if you become an investor who uses Token IQ technology to access 10 different issuers in a year, you're going to have 10 different wallets, 10 different issuers. But your process for signing up for them each time is a breeze. It's really only the first one that you have to provide a ton of that history data. So the scoring system itself works a couple of different ways. It matches up investors with the projects they want to see. Yep. It also prevents issuers from letting every investor in to see their project. If they want it to be somewhat exclusive, they may, the scoring system 1 to 100, basically, if you only want 77 scores of 77 and up, just like a credit score, then they get filtered views on the investor side of things. And only investors that had at least that aggregate score of 77 and above can then log in and see these. So it's, and if you know how distributed ledger works from there on in, the KYC data, along with our always on audit trail that we mentioned earlier, is constantly validated. And anybody that needs to look up historical data, anybody that needs to look up anything about a particular issuer or a transaction that occurred, have at it. It's all there and in our KYC engine, which is embedded, by the way, at the wallet level.
Yeah.
So that's how we keep it within kind of a sterile ecosystem. That's not to say that ecosystem cannot then be white labeled to other services. It's actually kind of one of our secondary directions, because there's a lot of interest to use it like that. Our KYC engine itself is turning out to be quite robust in those ways, because it just enables access and functionality. We're not an encryption and data storage company.
Right.
So we don't have certain features that others in that realm might house, but we have the ability to also scale up this service. If there are jurisdictions and even the SEC that requires different, more robust authentication data in the future, we scale our platform by writing new logic onto it and switching it over pretty seamlessly. So it's an elegant solution.
That's interesting. So just to clarify for people that are listening and for myself, is what you're saying, it's all internal. It's all in-house. You guys have developed this, and this is not a third-party solution that you've integrated or partnered with another firm for.
Well, the data is third-party. And that's what actually kind of what is important, because who's going to trust Token IQ to say which data is validated, right? We kind of have to go to somebody who's got that type of authority, that type of track record.
Right.
That's what KYC is. So we as Token IQ aren't saying our data is the one to validate against. We're actually just creating the tools to validate against the data that does allow for that.
Gotcha. So let's go back to the part you mentioned about how the data that you do have right now, just because of the stage of the development you're in, is US focused. And I go through the same thing with anything related to due diligence or background checks. It's a lot easier to get vast amounts of data, whether as a PI or otherwise, within the United States. It's a pain in the ass in Europe, or at least within the European Union. Okay. Within parts of Asia, it's a pain in the ass for a different reason, largely because the language barrier and the difference in how and why that data is collected and by the sorts of companies that are doing it. Yeah, of course, there's Facebook everywhere, but that's not what we're talking about. It's generally different kinds of data brokers, maybe data companies that just aggregate this stuff. And it does end up in advertising platforms, but that's not where it starts. So tell us about just those jurisdictional challenges that you see ahead and how you are planning to handle compliance issues, to handle scaling, and really anything that goes along with, let's take this thing that's working here in the States and let's start evolving, because it's a big world.
Yeah, Philip, why don't you take that one? Because you've had so many conversations over in the East lately.
Well, I think we can break that down sort of into a two-part answer. Part of it being the patents, which will protect our intellectual property. But that also feeds into the second, sort of the primary part of the answer, in that, again, we provide a software solution. And the vision that we had sort of from day one was to build a framework, to build a SaaS, a software as a service solution, that is able to essentially take this framework, right, built on Stellar and our platform, and apply it to any market, to any jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Now, and this comes into one of the factors that's important here, is that TokenIQ focuses on the technology. A lot of our frenemies, as Ben likes to say, they try to be a little bit of everything to everybody. They are not just doing the tokenization platform, but they're trying to do trading, and they're trying to do market making and consulting and marketing. And the message kind of gets muddled. Mm-hmm. And frankly, it's very difficult for many companies, especially smaller and mid-sized startups, to be everything to everybody and be good at everything. To Mark's, again, Mark, our founder, to his credit, from day one, he had the realization that let's be good at one thing, and that is the technology aspect. So the way that we approach that is that we partner upstream and downstream with other firms who are the best at what they do, whether it's that they are the best at marketing, or the best at being a broker dealer, or the best at legal compliance, or the best at preparing tokenomics, anything. Mm-hmm. We partner with those firms. So it's much simpler for us to your question, for us to go into Europe, for us to go into Asia, to go into Latin America, South America, and find the best of breed in those respective verticals, whether it's upstream or downstream, and say, hey, we have the technology, let's partner with you. You guys know the compliance, you guys know GDPR in Europe, and you're the best at it. Let's partner with you guys and be the best. So it's a great question. It really is. And I think that's something that a lot of our frenemies may struggle with. So Ben, do you want to add to that a little bit?
Yeah, I have one thought to add. It's taking everything you're saying, Phil, it's kind of like this, Colton. How do you achieve really like the compliance aspect of it, right? Mm-hmm. What we're finding is we're taking all the information that's diluted in these professionals' minds, and it's not just one partner that we're working with on the legal side or one on the broker-dealer. We're amassing worldwide relationships. We've got dozens in every category. The ones that seem to fit the bill for a particular engagement, though, right? It might look something to the degree of them engaging with us, but then us also having what I like to call the right toolbox. Mm-hmm. They can come to us because we've made a platform that is quite incapable of printing something that's not compliant.
Yeah.
So if you can think about it this way, we would come to them, they would say, we have an offering and it needs to be in this jurisdiction with these rules. You'd say, great, we don't know anything about those rules, maybe, right? We've never done any business here. But good thing for you is TokenIQ is a platform that can still mint it. You just have to give us the design.
Okay.
Right? It's like they're coming to us to build a house. Stellar is the toolbox. It's got saws, hammers, screwdrivers, tape measures, all the stuff that you would need to make a compliant house. But a compliant house is going to look different in Seattle than it is in LA, than it is in the Philippines, than it is in Denmark, than it is in blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So, but the tools don't change. The building process doesn't change, right? The carpenter knows what he needs to do. So that's like us. We know exactly what we need to do, when we need to do it, but we're at the end of the process. Hmm. So if by the time a designed issuance token, issued token was to come to the point where it was minted and it was missing some key components, we would know. Equivalent of a syntax error on a calculator, right? Hey, this, I don't know how to calculate this. So if that happens, there's actually that in place. We can send it back upstream, say, hey, you guys didn't consider this. You didn't cover the bases here. Go fix, then bring back. So in that same way, it's basically like, you know, we're a McDonald's that's incapable of building a burger with salmonella in it type of thing, right? It's the same like ordering procedure, but there's like some other vetted mechanism there in between the customer saying, all right, I can always guarantee I can eat this crappy burger, but.
Well, you heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen, Ben Welkening, TokenIQ is McDonald's. That's the brand association. No,
it's actually a really poor, it worked for the one, the one action, I guess, but
I'm having fun with that though. So you know, and to continue having a little bit of fun at some other people's expense, because that's how we like to do it around here. The verticals that you've been involved in so far, we've talked about real estate, and real estate is the one that gets a lot of attention, but I'd like to talk about some of the other potential, and where I will have fun at the expense, it also will betray maybe a lack of cultural sophistication on my part, but you take modern art, for instance, and the interpretation of what is art, and then you also look at the association of the art trade with money laundering, and I find that whole scenario very fascinating. When is a piece of like a paper plate with mustard on it, when is it art and it's a $15 million transaction that can be walked across the border in a suitcase, or when is it just garbage? So that's going to be a fun thing to explore in the coming years. But why don't we just talk on a more serious note about things that aren't real estate, and they aren't necessarily security in the traditional sense, like here's a business, it's making money. Let's talk about collectibles, let's talk about cars. What's that like?
It's a new market category that's spinning up, and it's quite video game like in its nature, honestly. And I've heard plenty of anecdotes from Mark working with him now for long enough to hear that people buy anything, and they'll buy really stupid stuff too. Not just stuff that's totally valueless to some people. This whole phenomenon around what's the apparel company, Supreme? Have you heard of this? Like the apparel company Supreme. It's ridiculous. The really, really crappy stuff that they make, like below board, it just says Supreme with a thing on it. Yeah. But there's like a Twitter campaign or something that goes out, and there's one of these at this store.
Yeah.
First one comes to buy it wins. And everybody does it, right? You jump how high. So
so you're saying that mustard plate has a chance.
It has kind of a chance. Yeah, that's almost kind of what actually gonna tie it back to right there was the mustard plate. So very, very good. So if you can kind of understand people to that extent, like it's really easy to see where they would actually spend money on. Cars are one that's quite untapped as, if you asked everybody if they're driving their dream car or own their dream car, they're gonna say no, right? That plain and simple. There's a ton of opportunity there. Mm-hmm. If everybody can say no, then well, what's the willingness quotient for them to want their dream car? Just the fact of the matter is they're breathing the words dream car means they're dreaming of something. Right. So everybody typically. Art cars, they have this kind of illustrious, ethereal, but almost untouchable quality to them.
Sure.
So now what we have is we provide access to ownership in the real estate realm and other securities realms by fractionalizing the offerings, right? Well, you can apply that to something like automobiles as well in all sorts of different ways. We're still exploring this category, but there are opportunities in auctioning off from the high net worth auction companies.
Right.
There are, I mean, we've got one of the big ones just here in town that just got done. Barrett Jackson, right? Barrett Jackson, they had Sotheby's roll through, they had Bonhams roll through and Goodings and all these other big auction companies.
Yeah.
We got to see how those worked from a different perspective. And without, it's I can't reveal too much what we're doing there really, because I,
sure.
Without talking about it, just like around the skirts, because we're still kind of in discovery phase with a lot of these discussions. That show was only a couple weeks ago, and
right.
And we're kind of working through the parameters of how to engage with this. But what we do know is that the desire is there.
Yeah.
Ideas range from tokenizing a car that's unreachable for somebody, a car that might be worth $50 million.
Right.
It's insane to think that that's the case, but that there are cars that are that.
Right.
And if you can break down that car into an ownership category where, shoot, everybody knows how Patreon works, right?
Right.
Pay this much, you get this much in return for your reward system.
Unless
pay this much in this tier. What's that?
Unless you say the wrong thing and then you get nothing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, this is an interesting angle, though. I don't want you to have to, like you said, maybe it's best to leave it to the imagination.
No, I think I'm inferring enough, I think, for people who are going to pick up on it, right? Like,
sure.
Imagine with your ownership, I guess I'll just close out with, imagine actually being able to drive your dream car because you're a part owner in that very car, right? It's the type of thing. The reward systems explode from there, but that's the idea.
That's an interesting angle, you know, from the consumer angle. I also think from the angle of the dealer or the brand, it's going to be important to
transfer of ownership.
Yeah, well, and also secondary market prices for things like Lamborghinis that have become quite common, which I know sounds ridiculous, but I was just talking to Philip about this. And I saw an article shortly after we had that conversation that was this is from a woman who's a consultant for the automotive industry dealing with brands like that. And they have this real problem where they've become ubiquitous enough within the past 10 years or so that there's a lot of them on the road. The secondary market for them, the prices are just plummeting. You can get very, very nice cars for just dirt cheap relative to what they used to be. So there's basically no resale value relative to what it was. It's not an attractive thing. And people are, those who are buying new are getting fewer and further between. So it's hurting their primary sales as well.
And yeah. If I can add a little bit to that, on two topics, one, the luxury car, the ultra luxury car market, and then I'll go back to the art market in a moment. I think the true benefit and the sort of that aha moment that a lot of people will have in the luxury car market is when you realize that you can buy, you know, a $300,000, $400,000 Lamborghini, and you can leave it in your third house or however many houses you have down in Miami. And I mean, I was in Miami for Art Basel. And I was actually, I remember I called Ben, I was on the phone with you one evening as I was driving around in traffic, and I'm sitting at a traffic light and I felt like I was in a movie. It was just a sea of Ferraris and Lamborghinis. I mean, I was the only person there who didn't have, you know, $250,000 car.
Yeah.
So what you realize is that a lot of these people are buying these cars and they are driving it a few weeks a year because it's in their third or fourth vacation home that they only fly into every once in a while. And for 50 weeks of the year, let's say, this asset is just sitting there parked, just parked. Yeah. With tokenization, you can now actually utilize that asset and actually lease it out, rent it out, do sort of, you know, a time sharing of these cars. And this can completely blow open the entire car market. I think that's going to be the big aha moment for a lot of these people, is that they're going to realize, like, wow, now I can actually utilize this $300,000 investment, so to speak, in a profitable way. Take one jump back to the fine art space. You bring up an interesting point about how it's a ugly thing to admit, but a lot of money laundering is conducted in this ultra fine art world, where paintings are being, or pieces of art are being sold for tens of millions of dollars. The reason that can happen is because, again, this all goes back to risk and transparency and liquidity. Mm-hmm. The reason that can happen is because you have a piece of art that is only sold once every few years, and you have almost no comparables to it. Mm-hmm. And you can make up a price, essentially. You can say, this piece of art is worth $20 million. Prove me wrong. Right? Mm-hmm. How can you say otherwise? Because you can't go back and look at the last week's or last month's or last year's historical data on the price.
Right.
When you can tokenize pieces of art, and now you instead of having one buyer that makes up the price, you have 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 investors who say, I really like this Rothko, so I'm going to buy a $10,000 share of this Rothko, or I really like this whoever artist that does up and coming, so I'm going to start buying them. Now you have a market. Yeah. Now you have liquidity. Now you have price transparency.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to say, well, you know, the market forces are saying that this piece of art is worth about $1 million. That's what the market supports.
Yeah.
You are going to be very hard pressed as a money launderer to walk in and say, oh, I think this piece of art is really worth $50 million. Because everyone's going to look at you and say, like, either you're an idiot, or B, you're trying to launder money. So
right.
Potentially, the tokenization of art could essentially nearly wipe out the money laundering aspect of that. And that would be amazing. It'd be wonderful.
Built in true price discovery.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that is a fascinating angle. And that's even without it being, checking against known money launderers, known criminals, whatever. That's without the data checks. This is just purely on an economic and technological level. Which is really, it's interesting when you can actually innovate through or around a problem without necessarily having to rely on just like mandatory enforcement measures. So that's cool. And, you know, I want to talk so much about that, but we've already spent a lot of time.
We've blown through an hour, haven't we?
Yeah. So, and that's okay. You know, we can go as long as you guys have, but I do want to move forward with just, the partnership side of the conversation. So I originally had found out about Token IQ just from some basic online research, but I didn't take a much closer look until I'd spoken with John Nance and Thomas Carter at Dealbox. And you guys have been working with them for a while now. So if you could just tell us about how that relationship developed and what it means for Token IQ.
Yeah, it's actually not a very sexy story, unfortunately. It's kind of a boring one.
Fair enough.
Thomas is one that met Mark just because they were doing, they're in the same circles for one. So they'd actually seen each other prior and I think even shaken hands,
mm-hmm.
but they were truly introduced by a mutual friend over, I believe it was actually a lunch in mm-hmm. Phoenix a couple of years ago. It was kind of around the same time that I started this call off by saying when I met Mark, in fact, right? And things progressed to the point where they weren't really sure if there was something there to partner with right then at the time.
Yeah.
They were really good sales guys, really good capital marketeers, very, very well connected individuals.
Right.
And realized that they were really good at selling something that they wanted to have a solution for but didn't know anybody. And Token IQ ends up being that very solution. And Thomas pretty soon realized how valuable of an asset Mark would be to his own success. Because without the technology, you can't deliver on what you're selling. So that was a pretty easy partnership. He's got relationships and knows exactly how to vet, knows exactly how to formulate these deals, what's needed, what's going to be required from regulations perspective to most tokens.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have kind of something that makes sense. Sure. And I wish it were more, you know, legendary than that. It's a pretty boring business deal at the end of the day.
That's all right though. You know, sometimes it comes down to it not having problems, you know, no red flags. And when you have a situation where your values are aligned as well, because the technology, not to slight Token IQ, but there are other providers. I mean, we've been talking about on the whole podcast, right? Mm-hmm. So that the values were aligned and that the priority and the strategy was aligned as well, that also obviously plays a factor. And while it might seem that it goes without saying from your perspective, from the outside looking in, for somebody who's listening to this, that's a good reminder. It's a good reminder to make sure that your companies are going the same direction, whether or not you would have ever met each other. So
that's the biggest thing. That's the biggest thing right there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, when looking at partnerships going into the rest of this year and how those would be modeled, you know, the ideal partnerships for Token IQ and what you're best positioned to bring to the table. Could you elaborate on that a bit more?
Phil, why don't you take that one?
Sure. Let me start off first by mentioning how we even look at the partnerships and sort of evaluate what partnerships we look at. And then I'll get back to your question, Colton.
Sure.
We have this philosophy, again, and as I mentioned earlier, because we're looking at partners upstream and downstream. Mm-hmm. And we have this mantra from the beginning that we are going to be regulatorily compliant, that the existing regulations, whether they're in the U.S. jurisdiction or any other country, are there and they exist. And it's futile and irresponsible almost to try to circumvent or even toe the line or try to push the limits a little bit to try to get around them. And so we look for partnerships that follow that same philosophy, that have an eye towards the future and are cutting edge and want to make, that sounds like a cliche, but want to make the world a better place through the use of technology. And we do our due diligence by looking at who the executives in the firm are, their past ventures, their successes, their other existing partnerships, whether they've established other relationships that are similar in the mindset to what our mindset is, mm-hmm. and really just make sure at the end of the day that we're on the same page, that we all have the same end goal to look at. In a certain way also, again, we're built on a SaaS model, on the software as a service model.
Right.
It's really, our main goal was to take away the pain points, to make life easier. We looked at where are the frictions, where are the costs, where are the delays in the market. And having come from a capital markets background, financial services background, I can attest to how frustrating some of those areas are. I mean, 18 years ago, I was working in the corporate actions department at a bank, and the complaints and grievances that I would hear on a regular basis were the same ones that I would hear 10 years later, and that I heard 5 years ago, and that I heard 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. So there, and a lot of them were just technology-based, that it was using old, outdated technology. And those old, outdated ways of doing things cause a lot of friction and frustration and costs. And I think Token IQ is best positioned to serve the existing traditional markets, including real estate, as you mentioned, first, and really be able to make a dent into tokenizing assets that people are familiar with already. We're not inventing some newfangled, crazy investment classes or investment vehicles. We're tokenizing private equity. We're tokenizing private debt, tokenizing real estate, things that people already understand. Now, of course, as things progress in a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, that may change. But we're well positioned to grow and adapt, I think. So,
gotcha. Definitely appreciate the the angle that you guys have taken and how, you know, the way that you develop your partnerships is directly in line with the way that you've developed your product and the way that the entire communication strategy, even down to the pitch deck and everything, is very consistent. And that's generally, in my opinion, a good sign. If you're doing your diligence on a company, it's a good sign when all of that stuff is consistent. Now, to touch on the due diligence aspect again, you'd already covered most of it, but I want to go back and just ask about a red flag situation. Everything else checks out, values seem aligned. What is something that is just going to kill a deal, absolute deal killer for you guys?
Well, I guess the only things we can speak to are speculative at this point, because we haven't run into something that would kill a deal midstream yet, right? We've talked to several companies that this is probably Colton, there is probably an anecdote I can share is that kills a deal is it in design. Mm-hmm. And that's mostly where it's going to be, is in design, because those red flags that we mentioned, right, they needn't be consequentially significant, right? Because if you know that you have the answer key, right, and you can check against it, then there isn't a problem when it really comes to the minting of. But bad design is rampant with everything. And the most common thing we're seeing now is the unwillingness to do a hybridized solution. You have a lot of different companies out there that are clinging to the old ICO design philosophy because they saw what it did,
right?
They saw what other companies did with it, and they saw that they could circumvent and get all this liquidity without having to dilute themselves, put performance milestones in front of it. What a lot of folks don't realize is TokenIQ enables all of those things too. But you have to, if you want to be successful with the speculative category of whatever you're building, you need to build an STO.
Sure.
And that's a neglect that a lot of people are, well, I have a utility token. I've designed a utility token. That's great. We never even purport to say that you need to change your ways with that.
Right.
But that's your utility model. You also need, if you want to put out there for people an ability for people to speculate and bring in this capital, you need to go the STO route. Right. Apple didn't make a fortune selling their shares by making you buy iPhones to buy the shares. Nope. That they made you pay dollars to buy shares of Apple. Right. The phones are their utility token. You go buy those, and the company exists because they make those. Mm. You, as the investor, get to speculate on them making phones. It's no different than utility tokens. I mean, and that's fundamentally, for some reason, missing from the mindset of so many that we talk to. Right. And it's quite simple. We're not purporting that you need to do anything other than hybridize your solution that you've done. You've got a great design on the utility side. In order for that to be compliant and you can make it relevant to people and trade the speculative nature of your company in the wild,
right,
you need to do the STO route. So the platform again is all about your selection at that point. And I think TokenIQ is one of the unique ones to absolutely cover all those bases that you need.
Sure.
But I'd really like for fewer people to concern themselves with those red flags for those reasons, right? There's not necessarily a reason to work around them, because we know that if they occur at all, then we know how to fix them. But we also know that they're going to occur if there's a red flag there. Again, we've got smart distributed ledger tech. We don't have to trust committees to the degree that we used to anymore. Take that mentality away, automate those decision-making powers onto the chain, and reduce down that power to only the people that need to required to have it in the first place. And that's kind of the idea there.
And gotcha. If I can jump in and add one thing to Ben's very good points. Sure. This is not something we've come across at TokenIQ yet, thankfully, but just speaking from my previous experience and what I've seen in business, and this I think is important for your audience to take away. And if they remember one thing, this is probably an important point. Any potential or prospective partner or client that would approach us and would imply or attempt to kind of circumvent existing regulations or their, you know, they, again, this is not something we've seen at Token IQ, but this is something I've seen in the past. But if it were to happen, any potential partner or client that tried to utilize us to circumvent existing rules, existing regulations, or to try to do anything nefarious, we're going to, if for back, lack of a better term, if they just have, if they were just kind of sleazy and what they were trying to do was sleazy and we didn't feel, you know, it, let's put it this way. We would never do anything that we wouldn't want our moms to know about.
We can fire our own customers if we have the discretion to fire our own customers, exactly. Just as anybody else does, right?
All right.
Exactly. And I think it's, I think that's an important point to make clear that, you know, if you see that we are doing business with a client or that we are doing a partnership with a partner, people can sort of, they can rest assured that was a key factor in our decision, that they're people we trust and people that that are on the same page as we are in terms of regards for laws and regulations. So
good. And on that note, you know, one of the most important parts of this show is I do like to ask for your, you know, the kind of people that you do trust, because everybody who's listening to this is looking for voices and insight they can trust in this space. And if there's anyone that you hold in such high regard, you'd recommend them without hesitation, this would be your opportunity to shine some light on their integrity and their skill.
Yeah, it's important too. I've got a couple of them that come to mind. First, you know, and foremost, I don't even know how you'd categorize him in respect to us, but Reggie Middleton over at Veritasium. Those guys seem to have capital markets down to the extent that you need to in the commodity space, and also in a pretty sophisticated research program plus clearinghouse functionality. Mm-hmm. I think it's in terms of who the exchanges should really be afraid of, it's those guys over there, the traditional exchanges, right? The NASDAQs of the world, you know, we're going to see that take off, I think, in terms of an idea. And I highly encourage people to look at his project. It's pretty cool. So him and what he says about compliance with how the markets operate is just brilliant. He's available. He does AMAs all the time on his YouTube channel and such. So I highly encourage that. Mm-hmm. And another one I'd really like people to look into is Caitlin Long. Mm-hmm. I've actually never touched base with either of these people. I've only had cursory relationship with either of them, but you know, which has amounted to nothing more than reaching out to really congratulate them on what they're doing in certain cases.
Sure. But
the legislative side of things that she's affecting, she just affected some legislation in Wyoming that doesn't necessarily move the needle in terms of what we're doing too much. But from the general sense, I like the path that she's carving. I really see where her vision is in making this new asset class and these new currencies classes operate the way they need to. And she comes from Wall Street too. She's kind of like a reformed banker and sees things outside of the rehypothecation realm that we all find our, you know, hopefully we can circumvent before it falls apart and we have to build it with distributed ledger tech anyway. Hopefully we can just get our foot in there. But anyway, those are a couple that come to mind for myself. What about you, Philip?
I'd say really we're on the same page. I think that also speaks a little bit to us being on the same page just in philosophy as well. I think of those three, I'm a big fan of Caitlin. Again, I like how you said that she's sort of a reformed Wall Street type, and I guess in a certain way, I do, now that I look at it that way, I guess I sort of am too. And again, because I saw in the operation side how inefficient and how much friction there was and how many failure points there were. And I think the capital markets, financial services space is long, long, long overdue for new technology. Now it's going to take time, but I think it's due. and also Reggie Middleton. I did have the pleasure of meeting him very briefly a few months ago in Miami during Art Basel. Mm-hmm. Great guy, great ideas, great vision. I only had the pleasure of speaking with him for a few minutes. He's the kind of person I wish I could just buy him lunch and sit down with him for an hour, 2 hours, and just pick his brain. He's just a great guy to talk to, frankly.
Well, if you're listening, Reggie Middleton, you've got a free lunch waiting. So that's great, guys. I appreciate that, and it definitely means a lot when someone can speak so positively of people they've encountered, even if they haven't gotten to know them. We've had some great names come up in these episodes before, and it's always helpful. Caitlin Long, I also have been very interested in seeing what's been happening in Wyoming. I use Wyoming for LLC purposes. Their whole history of being a really great environment for doing business and a model for what the rest of the country does and what then by knock-on effect what the rest of the world does in the business space and within asset management. It's very fascinating stuff. So we're going to mull those over, maybe try to contact those people. And beyond that, though, let's talk very quickly about your favorite deal story. So negotiation, outcome, serendipity, something that will offer a lesson to the audience.
Yeah. Some people might have heard this one before because it's quite the success story. And it's with our first customer, in fact, Oxygen Hospitality. The reason why it's noteworthy is because they looked kind of beyond our offering itself and said, I can really create anything with this, right? Securities are securities. I can create anything. It's, yeah, as long as you design it, is what Mark's standpoint was with Peter over at Oxygen, Peter Anadranostakis, if anybody wants to look him up. It does sound phonetically just how as I said there, but it's kind of hard to spell, Anadranostakis. They had a property development deal out in Palm Springs. Mm-hmm. And perfect for the concept that they've envisioned for their company. It's a new hospitality concept that will appeal to millennials. It'll be quite involved with all sorts of blockchain tech eventually, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. Very cool. They determined this is a perfect piece of property. It was a $10 million note that they were going to need to develop it. And instead of going and getting the money loaned from the traditional route, they decided to fractionalize the offering and tokenize that debt to people who wanted to purchase it because they could fractionalize it to the point where it was attractive to these people that Phil was talking about, doctors, lawyers, dentists, these guys actually have quite a bit of money, even software engineers, right?
Yeah.
And maybe not the liquid cash for your typical real estate deal that's going to cost you $200K just to get into.
Right.
So it brought it down to the affordability level where they had absolutely no problem getting this thing marketed, getting people interested in it. And from there, they're going to tokenize not only more things on this project, but tokenize their other projects similar ways. So they're kind of blazing a trail and writing templates for themselves as they go to make their own lives easier. And it's all because of Token IQ enabled tech. It's pretty exciting.
That's excellent. It's really solid.
And one more thing I'll mention to Ben's point.
Sure.
Going back quite a few questions, but early on in this conversation, where we mentioned that we've kind of organically, sort of the universe almost has kind of taken us to the real estate space. We did the Oxygen deal, and that was in the media and the press, and we started having a lot of other real estate firms, real estate development firms start coming to us and saying, hey, we like what you did, tell us more. So we it kind of was a self-fulfilling prophecy almost, where we wanted to get more folks in the real estate, and we got picked up in the press, and we kind of had some buzz around that. And now we're having real estate developers and firms come to us. Mm. So I think it should be good for 2019. So.
Excellent. That's really great news. And I'll have to look more into that story. It's always great when your product development and your marketing strategy is purely informed by early client and customer needs. Companies that arise out of actually solving a problem, that's supposed to be a no-brainer, but unfortunately, over the past year, we saw that that is not the case. So now that we're talking about lessons learned, this is another good part of the show where I will ask you if you have any final words of wisdom that you'd like to share with everybody who's listening right now.
Yeah, I mean, I've got, it's relevant to crypto, and I actually won't, maybe we should do a whole nother show on this sometime, Colton, the whole deal going on down in Venezuela and really pick it apart. But I urge people to watch what's happening in Venezuela. It is not what the United States government would purport it to be.
Yeah.
And all of this socialism talk is real interesting because you really look into what's built down in Venezuela, it's not socialistic whatsoever. In fact, it's, well, not whatsoever, I wouldn't say, but it's maybe got components of it, but it's not a socialist government. The United States, with its social security system, in fact, and its welfare up the yin yang, much more favors socialistic mentalities than other countries. And so just watch what the petro is. It's being taken in trade by many, many countries, including Russia, China, India, all of Africa, most of the Middle East.
Yeah.
OPEC is going to be changing to something I can't even fathom, probably. And we'll just see how long the U.S. petrodollar standard lasts at the end of all of it, suffice to say.
That's a lot to chew on. That's a whole cow to sink our teeth into. So
it's all investigative research and speculation at this point, right? But watch that story.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you are listening, I'll tease a little bit. We might have some interesting new material for you to listen into soon. So with that being said, how about you, Phil? What have you got to share with listeners?
Nothing as sensational or exciting as Ben Crawford. But, you know, one thing I will say is that what we've been seeing in the crypto digital asset industry and world, I guess at this point it really is an industry, we can call it that now, is how quickly things are changing and how compressed traditional time frames are, traditional timelines are. Yeah. You go back and you look at the dot-com, growth of the dot-com in the 90s, you know, things which took about 10 years to gain momentum and become commonplace and become accepted. Now you have similar life cycles that are taking 6 months, a year, year and a half. You know, the whole ICO craze started and effectively collapsed in what, 12 to 18 months?
Yeah.
The dot-com bubble life cycle was a 10-year life cycle. It started in the early 90s and really collapsed around 01, 02. But to that point, I think it's good that we're seeing this kind of ICO winter or ICO collapse, because it's sort of shaking out a lot of the less desirable entities that are out there that might have not had a long-term vision and the markets and the world's best interests at heart. So I actually think this shakeout is actually pretty good. But just the rapidity and how quickly things are moving. I mean, you look even at the traditional capital market space, decimalization in the U.S. for equities. That was a multi-year process. Dematerialization of equities in the U.S. That was a multi-year process. And that took from the first mention of it to the actual final execution. That was like a 10, 15 year process, right? Digital assets, this is what, maybe a 3 year process, 2-3 year process, and we're on the cusp of it becoming truly viable and acceptable and almost, I would dare to say, almost a commonplace solution and technology. So things are moving fast, very fast, which is good. So.
It is. And if you're listening right now and you're wondering, is it too late to get more involved? If you're kind of on the outside looking in, then the answer is no. And if you're thinking, is it too much to keep up with as just one man or woman? The answer is yes. So quickly get yourself involved with some clever people who know more than you do. you know, it doesn't necessarily mean you need to start a podcast, but find a way, get involved with something, contribute to a open source project, or get involved with some community, or go, you know, start looking at job openings or pick up a book, do something, because it's going to be one of those things that suddenly is all around you and you're going to have to know what's going on anyway. So do get involved. And on that note, when they want to connect with Token IQ and when they would like to connect with you guys individually, what's the best way for them to do that?
TokenIQ.io is our website. We actually have, if anybody wants to see Mark coming up, there's a really good opportunity for them to do so on February 21st, 6:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, so 5:30 p.m. Pacific, 8:30 p.m. Eastern. I'm guessing your audience is mostly U.S., Colton. Like, I can rail off more time zones if I try, I guess. But I think that gives it's called Thrive VHX. PHX Startup Week. Again, that's Thrive PHX for Phoenix Startup Week. And Thursday evening, February 21st, Mike Jones is going to be interviewing him and talking about a lot of the topics we've talked about here, but you'll hear it from the horse's mouth and probably get some unique perspective. So that's a unique opportunity. And we're going to be going to conferences, trade shows, and all the like here in the spring. And so if you tour around and go to Austin or Seattle or New York or San Francisco, LA, all these places we're going to be, Las Vegas, you're likely to happen upon us there too. But expect more engagements like this too, I suppose. We always love educating through interviews and podcasts and the like.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, gentlemen, for taking the time. I know we went a good bit longer than we were going to, but I really appreciate it. And everybody, that was Ben Wilkening and Phil Silichanu. This is Token IQ. Go to tokeniq.io, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Colton.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Pendulum Insight Podcast. If you learned something today and you want to know more, go check out penduluminsight.com.